Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
The Denisons, the Denisons, the busiest in the biz. You do know who it is, it's Dennis Quaid. That's him.
Hi, this is Dennis Quaid, and you're listening to the Denisons. On this episode, I talk with Billy Ray Cyrus about his career, his recent success with Old Town Road, going all the way back to Achy Breaky Heart. We hope you enjoy this episode.
You know, one of my questions, though, is going to be how you guys met.
She stalked me.
She stalked you. And that was before social media or iPhones, I guess, right?
I was so high and drunk, it wouldn't have mattered, you know?
Was it a gig?
It was a gig. I played 5 nights a week in Huntington, West Virginia.
Yeah.
Hottest spot. Like, you couldn't get in there even on a Sunday night. Like, it was just made for people from Kentucky, Ohio, and West Virginia, the tri-state area.
Yeah.
And at that time, Kentucky was dry. So, like, if people wanted to party at night and actually go to a bar, they either had to go to Southern Ohio or Southern West Virginia. And I would alternate between the two. I'd play in Ohio for a couple years, and then if the club burnt down or something happened, then I'd move up to West Virginia. I'd ping pong it a little bit, but the great thing was our fan base was so strong between those three states.
Right.
And it was kind of like I was already famous, but I wasn't famous.
Yeah, I heard you were
only
like,
in that little place.
You were selling out every night. Is that where Harold Shedd met you?
Yeah, Harold Shedd sent Buddy Cannon, the head of A&R for Mercury Records.
Right.
And what was interesting, there was a concert in Freedom Hall, which is a big venue, Louisville. Louisville's really almost a couple hundred miles away from Flatwoods, down the Ohio River. And some reason or another, the gig hadn't sold much. And it was tough times probably. But it was Reba McEntire and Highway 101.
Yeah.
And somebody had mentioned, you put this kid on from Flatwoods, Kentucky, and this thing will sell out. And so they put me on, and it sold out, and Buddy Cannon came up, and that was
that he brought you to Nashville, right?
Well, no, not exactly.
But he brought you.
He gave me just enough incentive not to give up on the idea of it. It was 2 years from the day that he came to see me play before they signed me to a contract.
Yeah. Did you resist Nashville at all?
Not near as much as it resisted me.
You were rock and roll at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much, but now I played as country can be, too.
Yeah, like, well, you are as country can be.
I am. Actually even wrote a song called Country as Country Can Be. Wrote it with my buddy Casey Beathard, but I am as country can be. That's my roots. I mean, again, in that area, I'd open up for George Jones, or I'd open up for REO Speedwagon, or Dr. Hook, or Richard Marx, or Reba McEntire, Highway 101, just wherever they'd let me on the stage.
Yeah.
And I could adapt to just about any crowd, any situation. What I loved, you asked, did I resist Nashville in the Nashville way? I probably could have got a record deal maybe 8 or 10 years earlier had I conformed and said, okay, man,
but you went to LA for that.
I did.
I want to get to all that when we go, but I kind of like start at the beginning if you don't mind.
I was born on August 25th, 1961, Our Lady at Bellefonte Hospital.
Yeah. And your dad, he was a politician.
He wasn't at the time.
At the time?
No, he was a steel worker for the Armco Steel that whole region is built around the Ohio River and coal mines and right. steel mills. And my dad, he had a gospel quartet that was in my grandfather's church. My grandfather, Papa Cyrus, was a Pentecostal preacher. Mm. And my dad's group sang in that church. And really, again, throughout the Ohio River Valley, the tri-state area, my dad and his group were famous. And they'd be on the Happy Goodman Sunday morning show.
Oh,
and,
that's great.
And that's where I fell in love with harmony. And that's when, if somebody right. was in the group and had to set out, I'd step in and sing their parts. I just loved harmony.
Harmony is hard to just up and learn just right off the bat. Mm-hmm. You got to hear it, and it's that's where it just sort of soaked into you from mm-hmm. there, I would guess, right? But that's the first music you can remember hearing as a kid. Who do you first remember hearing on the radio or listening to?
Tying in the fact that, so I had this one very influential grandfather that was the preacher and my dad's gospel group, it's Papa Cyrus, but my mom's dad, his name was Bill Casto,
mm-hmm.
and he was a fiddler from Charleston, West Virginia.
Wow.
And he raised hell and rode the caboose on the Seno Railroad. So I always had this, I had two different grandfathers and two different styles of music. My Papa Casto style was "Won't You Come Home, Bill Bailey," rolling in my sweet baby's mm-hmm. arms, mentioning what's the first thing I hear on the radio. Mm-hmm. Well, my life at that time as a 3, 4, 5-year-old boy, on Saturday nights I'd be at my Papa Casto's house, and he'd get that fiddle out. My uncle would play the guitar, and my mom would play the piano, and they'd just kind of, it was kind of like honky-tonk feel-good music.
Right. We're talking about the 60s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Growing up.
Yeah.
Around there.
But they would play I guess, things that maybe my mom grew up on. So she played by ear, and she'd play the piano. It just felt like feel-good, I don't know, kind of in the way they was rocking. But yet it was fiddles and a bit smoky. Yeah, my papa drank a little beer, you know.
Kind of music thrown extremely. In there. You know, I think Johnny Cash, it was a little bit later he had his TV show, but...
it came right in there.
The music back then was like that. And I had kind of the same thing. My grandmother played the piano, and my cousin is Gene Autry, third cousin.
I didn't know that.
from Oklahoma.
Man.
And there was always, go to my grandmother's house, and it'd be like a show. Everybody had to get up and do something, whether it was.
Well, so you know the deal.
Were taught that you had a talent. We're going to find out what
you're
going
to have a song coming and get ready, and you get to get up, take the floor.
Yeah.
Man, there's so much talent comes out of Oklahoma. Like, I mean, that's just. You hear that cliche, there's something in the water. There is something
in the water, and it's a way of getting out into the big world, because you just feel like you've got to get out. And those roots they're great roots to have. They really are. I used to be jealous of people, you know, that grew up in New York or L.A., being from Texas, because that was like, you know, where the world was really happening, I suppose, as far as being an artist or an actor or a musician at that time. And that I came to realize that I actually had an advantage over them, because nobody moves to Houston or moves back to Flatwoods, Kentucky from New York or L.A. So, you know what I mean? You have the benefit of both as far as culture goes.
Right on.
Yeah. But when did you start playing guitar?
Well, I was going to be a professional baseball player, and I really started playing as early as picking up a guitar and trying to play. I should adjust that statement. But everybody in my family played right-handed.
Yeah.
And you can see I'm very left-handed.
I'm a left-handed, too.
Do you play a left-handed guitar when you play?
No, I'm left-handed to begin with.
So do you play a
I play right-handed.
See, if I could have done that, I tried, but I just thought I couldn't play. And so
it took me a long time to pick it up, too, because I was told it was a right-handed guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And so it took me a few years before I got one. But So did it feel unnatural to you to play right-handed?
I just thought God didn't give me the gift.
Yeah.
That everybody else could play by ear. And I just thought, okay, I hear harmonies and I hear music and I love music, but God didn't give me the gift to play guitar. And so I thought I was going to be Johnny Bench. I was going to be the next catcher for the Cincinnati Reds.
Right on.
When you grow up right there in the Ohio River Valley, that's...
Reds
are everything. That. Well, I threw baseball right-handed.
See, really?
That's why I thought I would play like everyone else, because I threw baseball right-handed. Huh. I bat right-handed.
Right.
Now, oddly enough, I did kick left-footed. I don't know why. Huh. Something was very messed up with me. Still is. But that being said...
I'm very confused myself right now, being left-handed and right-minded like
I'm
we
serious.
Are. I'm
you should
still
see me
confused.
Trying to figure out how to brush my teeth. It's like, which hand am I going to use? You know what I mean? Or do I do it with my left foot? I mean, to this day, it's confusing. But that being said, I go, I'm going to be Johnny Bench. It don't matter. I mean, I'm being scouted by both the Reds and the Dodgers, and I did love the Dodgers a lot, too, though that was the
back
Reds.
The Cincinnati-Boston World Series.
Yeah.
I think, my favorite World Series I ever saw.
It was up there.
Even though it ended in Game 6, but what an incredible. And Johnny Bench, amazing.
Yeah. Pete Rose.
Yeah.
Pete Rose. Surely they're going to do the right thing, put him in the Hall of Fame right now while he's alive.
Why not?
Put him in the Hall of Fame. There's enough going on.
Yeah.
Put Pete Rose in the Hall of Fame.
Else a slide.
He deserves it.
Give him one, too.
He deserves it. Pete Rose deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. He really does.
I completely agree.
He really does.
So I started thinking about it. You played Little League, and you were in a high school ball. And
yeah.
They scouted you. And you
were I was on my way.
You were on your way.
I was on my way. It was going to be one or the other. The Reds or the Dodgers, either one. You know, my heart, though, was maybe with the Reds.
But you were a pitcher and a catcher?
No. I would pitch. If we ran out of pitchers, I would take the gear off and go out there and pitch if it came down to it. But I preferred – I loved being behind the plate. Like, to me, it's what my music is now. When I get in and get on my guitar and I get in the band, in some ways I still feel like I'm on that team in the infield and behind that plate, because when you're behind the plate, you're quarterback, and you're involved in every single play.
Yeah.
And I used to go out and tell my pitchers every now and then, I'd say, you know what this is now? It's me and you playing keep away against the batter. And I loved when some of my pitchers learned to throw a good curveball or a drop ball or even a knuckleball, which is impossible to catch because you never know how it's going to move. But the better the arsenal.
As a catcher, you know, you're back there, and you can see the whole field. You can see everybody's facing towards you, your players.
That's right.
The players. And you're really kind of – you're right. You're kind of like the conductor. You got control of everything that's going to happen if you played it right, and keeping everybody's morale, especially the pitcher, back there.
I used to do this thing. Part of my job, too, was to get into the psyche of the opposing team. So if they swung and whiffed on a ball, I might, for a split second, show it to them before I threw it back to them. I wouldn't always be a butthole, but sometimes that was a bit my job. Matter of fact, I wouldn't say extremely often, but sometimes my nickname was Blood, because I seldom – left the field that I wasn't bleeding from somewhere. And my players, guys on my team, they'd either call me Blood, and some called me Scrap, because I would scrap. Scrap means fight. And I get in a lot of fights, but in a way it was kind of my job. And if I could get a team so
rattled
that they were functioning on beating me up, that's fine with me. Beat me up, but let me win the game. And that was kind of my job.
A little psychological. So,
plus, I just liked it. It was like, I don't know, you probably know, my mom and dad got divorced when I was 5, and my life wasn't easy. Again, my dad, when he was a steel worker, and he saw a crane fall and cut a man's legs off. And that was a pinnacle moment in my dad's life, which turned out to be a life-changing event for me also. But my dad, somehow the steel company wasn't going to pay for the man's family and insurance. And it was kind of like he just really, I know it was different times, but the steel company let him down. Yeah. And my dad took that as, I'm going to stand up for working people. And he quit his job at the steel mill and went and put himself back through school. And he got a degree and became the head of the AFL-CIO of the state of Kentucky and a state representative from the 98th district of Greenup County, Kentucky.
And he was doing that for 21 years.
He retired. Too, right? 21 years he did that. And my dad, his music was serving working people. That was his passion. He would go to work every day for the working man. As a matter of fact, we talk about Merle Haggard, Working Man Blues. That was kind of like my dad's anthem, you know, that and Mama Tried.
Right.
You know, and my dad always had a Merle Haggard 8-track cassette of something in his car. And a lot of times if he wasn't home, I'd get his car and drive it up and down the creek and stuff and listen to that. And
well, that says a lot about the values that you grew up in. I mean, it sounds very much also like your grandfather being a Pentecostal preacher who is, that's what it is basically, helping people as well. And so you were instilled with that at early age. When your parents were divorced, did you live with your mom or your dad? Or
it was like I stayed with my mom like during the weekdays, and then at the weekends I'd go stay with my dad. But then my dad got really busy, and sometimes, like, instead of him being in Flatwoods, he lived in Frankfort, Kentucky, and that's where the capital is. Right. And so I would stay. I really lived with my papaw and mamaw Cyrus. When my mom and dad split, he kind of moved back in with his mom and dad in their old family home.
Yeah,
back in Flatwoods. And so when I'd go stay with my dad, I was really staying with my papaw and mamaw Cyrus for a lot,
right?
A lot of that time.
And that's, like I said, your grandfather was a musician.
Yes.
And this is where you came into the guitar, I guess. And what was the first song you learned to play, or that you wanted to play?
Well, I got to tell you, you know, again, I was like 19 or 20, maybe 20. And was in that moment of playing for, at that time, Georgetown College. Mm. And I went to Morehead on a scholarship. And I got kicked out of Morehead State University.
For what?
I had found a little stray dog on the highway that was starving. And I brought it into my dorm room and started taking care of it. And it became the dorm dog.
What was her name?
I was her name was Red. It was a little red, I guess you might call it like an Irish setter, you know, with long red hair. And so we called her Red.
Yeah.
And one day, while I was in class, the campus police came in and they drug her out and shot her. And I'm coming. Yeah, I know. It sounds like you can't make this up. But I come out of the class and all my buddies out there, you ain't going to believe it. They came and got Red. They shot up. Well, what? I lost my damn mind. I went into this fit of rage.
Oh, and wait a minute. Now, they shot her. They took her outside and shot her right there on the campus?
I'm pretty sure that's
there were like, no animal services people around or anything
so.
Like
Not
that?
Not at that time.
I know it. Or
I don't know.
Just like
no, she was the nicest dog in the world.
Jeez.
I know. That's what I said. And I said, couldn't you, you knew I was in class. I could have come here and got her and took her home, whatever. But anyway, so I flipped out. And on that given night, there was a lot of parties. And I attended them.
Yeah.
And I drank heavily.
Yeah.
And I got extremely intoxicated. And I got in this, it sounds horrible. But what? I got in this, I was drinking and driving. Yeah. And I wouldn't do this now.
And grief.
Oh, my Lord. I got in this old Camaro I had, and I drove through every presidential rose garden they had. If it said Morehead State, I tore through it in my car. And the next day, they asked me to leave. And I said, by God, I'd be glad to leave here. And that was it.
That was the end of your baseball
career.
That was
it. Well, for Morehead State.
Yeah.
Then I went and played in my region for a bit, and then I went to Georgetown, and it was at that time I start hearing this voice tell me to buy a guitar and start a band, and I'll find my purpose in life.
Yeah.
And it started dealing with me so heavy that my high school sweetheart broke up with me. And her family, number one, her dad wanted me to be the catcher for the Reds. And number two, they thought I was going crazy.
Yeah.
Could have been right on both counts. But that being said, this voice kept saying, buy a guitar and start a band, and you'll find your purpose in life. And I always knew.
Oh, what do you think the voice was?
I don't know. Intuition, inner spirit, maybe, you know, certainly maybe some type of guardian angels, or maybe one, maybe two, maybe ten. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But we all have an inner voice. We're made in the image of God. And I think we all have a chance inside of ourselves to tap into an inner voice that.
Sometimes that's two voices. One's telling me I can't, and one's telling me I can.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it always is. For every action, there is an opposite and equal reaction, and it must be as true as the light today, and canst not be false to any man or woman.
There you go.
It's just the law.
Right.
But that being said, I start hearing this voice, and I'm really flipping out at this point. My girlfriend's broke up with me. I've kind of lost my scholarship, and everything's a mess, and I win tickets. I'm working at a tobacco warehouse driving a forklift, and they start giving away tickets to see Neil Diamond in Charleston, West Virginia. And I'd never won anything in my life. And
this
I started
a radio contest.
And I started playing every hour. Well, I became obsessed with it because I knew when the day was over and I hadn't won, that then I could realistically tell myself I probably needed to go get some psychological help. Because this voice is, you know, it's probably not healthy. But instead, the last set of tickets they gave away at 11 p.m., I won. And all of a sudden, I won tickets to go see Neil Diamond. And it's like two or three days later, I'm driving to Charleston, West Virginia by myself. My girlfriend wouldn't go. She didn't want to go anywhere with me. She had broke up clean.
Yeah.
And so I went to the concert by myself to see Neil Diamond. And he was singing, Holly, Holy Nights, Holly, Holy Nights.
Holly,
and he started,
holy.
Yeah, Holly, oh, yeah, you know it. And people like standing up, and in them days, they're lighting their lighters up. And he's saying, in some ways, he was preaching a little bit, like, I don't care if you're a man or woman, rich or poor, white or black, where you come from, if you believe in your dreams, you can be everything you want to be in this world, and it's all about living for the light. It's all about having purpose. And it was that P word, purpose. I said, purpose. And then it was like hands were all around me, holding me. I know it sounds cliche to say that, but I felt like hands were completely, remember, one great big hand.
This is important.
Somehow surrounded me.
Yeah.
And I left that concert. And the next day went and bought. On the way home, I pulled my car over to the side of the road. And they called me Blood. I was a pretty tough redneck guy, you know. And I pulled my car over and I said, God, but I can't play guitar. And the voice said, buy a left-handed guitar. I didn't know there was a difference. I went and found one. I found one left-handed guitar the next day in Portsmouth, Ohio. And as soon as I picked it up, everything in my brain, I was like my brother and my dad and my mom. I could play. I just had the guitar the wrong way.
Was it an electric guitar that you got?
No, it was just an acoustic guitar.
Nobody ever mentioned that you could just string it the other way.
Well, I think it was a little more, and I didn't even know.
Of course not. But the only left-handed guitar player I can remember from back in those days was Jimi Hendrix, and he played his backwards and upside down.
Yeah.
And,
but even that, though, there's some technical issues, like with the bone and some stuff inside. Like, you almost have to, even if you flip one over, you have to rebuild it just a little bit.
Really?
Even Hendrix, like, he could turn it. But mine, this was an official left-handed guitar with the bone made to slat the way with the strings.
Right.
And just the second I held it, I just started playing. And then everything that I always wanted to play, I just played and sang. And I bought that guitar and went home that night and started a band that night. And by 2 weeks later, I was making my living playing music for people.
Yeah.
And
Was that with your brother?
With my brother and a couple other guys from the warehouse where I worked, the cigarette warehouse. And
and the band was called what?
Sly Dog. Yeah. We just had this old dog that only had one eye. The other eye he lost in combat, and it was sewed shut. His name was Spike. And Spike had lost all of his hair. And in the summer, it gets pretty hot up there and muggy. And Spike had rolled over. We started the band, and I said, man, we got everything but a name. And by that time, Spike rolled over. And every now and then in the summer, he'd get these things. We called them pecker gnats. And he'd get these gnats flying around his belly.
Yeah.
And he had a swarm of pecker gnats buzzing over him there. And I said, I know, it's horrible, isn't it? We can edit this.
No,
right?
We're keeping the pecker gnats.
You can't say pecker gnats. You can't say pecker gnats on a podcast.
Well,
that's what they are.
Scientists call no-see-em bugs.
Some might call it a no-see-em, but these was big enough you could see. And Spike rolled over in all of his glory, and there he was. And I don't know, my drummer, his name was Bubba Wildman, said, Spike, you old sly dog, you. And I said, Sly Dog, let's be Sly Dog. So to this day, I still name my band Sly Dog.
Yeah.
Hey, Dennis Quaid here. You may know that I'm a musician and a huge music fan, and I want to tell you about a new podcast that I discovered. I've been listening to Eric Krasno Plus One, a podcast hosted by Grammy Award-winning guitarist and producer Eric Krasno. I love the interviews. They go deep with musicians, and you hear stories of life in the studio, life on the road. Those are really good. Or bad, depending on which side of the story you're on. You got stories with bandmates and all the other shenanigans that go on behind the scenes. On Plus One, Eric has candid conversations with legendary musicians, many who are also his friends. And at the end of each episode, Eric plays a favorite track from his guest. So it's great for discovering new music, too. On Plus One, Eric has candid conversations with legendary musicians, many who are also his friends. And at the end of each episode, Eric plays a favorite track from his guest. So it's great for discovering new music, too. Eric's talked to people like Dave Matthews, Marcus King, Chris Robinson, and upcoming episodes feature conversations with John Mayer, Questlove, Derek Trucks, Phil Lesh, and so many more. So take a listen to Eric Krasno Plus One. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere you get your podcast. Hi, Dennis Quaid here. Hey, we all have tough days and things that interfere with our happiness or achieving our goals. If you are looking to better yourself, then you should look into BetterHelp. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P. BetterHelp evaluates what you need and connects you to your very own licensed professional therapist. You'll be connected in less than one day, and you can send messages to your counselor anytime, day or night. This is not self-help, but it is professional counseling from the comfort of your own home. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you could schedule your own weekly video or phone sessions. Confidential, convenient, professional, and affordable. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/Quaid. Join over 800,000 people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Quaid.
So you started just playing gigs, went out and hunted them down?
Well, I found out that people would let you play just about anywhere if you did it for free.
Right.
And so immediately I had a blue light special on Sly Dog that if you had a pool party, house party, anything, right, we'll come play for it. And luckily, there was a prison out there called Summit Prison. And Summit Prison gave us our first real gig. And so we went into Summit Prison, and all the prisoners had made posters with their paint and the whole thing said, "Welcome, Sly Fly." And I thought, "Wait a minute, it's okay. They call us Sly Fly. We're going to be Sly Fly today, guys."
They must have heard about those Peckerwoods.
Yeah, they must have heard that. I know. It was kind of like that. I was like, yeah. Sly Fly. So we played that first gig, and it went really well. And work got around town. All of a sudden, what happened was, like, I went to the first place over in Ironton, Ohio, a bar over there called the Sandbar, and they didn't have a band.
Yeah.
And I went in there and somehow convinced the owner that if he'd let me and my band come in there, we'd play for the door, but his empty bar wouldn't be empty no more.
Right.
And I didn't really have anything to base that on, but I just said it. And lo and behold, he put us in there, and what happened was he started growing really fast, and all of a sudden his bar was the bar to come to, and it was packed. And then not only was we playing for the door, but he'd pay us. And, like, I started making my living playing music.
Wanted to keep you around.
Yeah, and we stuck around.
How much did you make back then? What year are we talking about now? We're talking about, well, I guess.
1982.
Yeah.
83.
Yeah.
And then somewhere in 82 and 83, I moved to another bar called Changes. And the Sandbar and Changes was competing against each other.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, in my Flatwoods, Kentucky ways, again, I didn't do that great in school, but all of a sudden I realized the negotiating power of...
You had leverage.
You let these guys, yeah, which one's going to pay you the
you
most,
the market
and that's
covered.
Where your band will play.
Yeah.
So we moved up to Changes, and it was really cool, and it grew and grew and grew, but in 1984, it burnt to the ground. And by then, I had already been turned down by Nashville many times.
All your equipment, too. To
lost
with,
everything.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And by then, I'd opened up for George Jones and just many, many acts coming through that area. And going down to Nashville, every time they'd say, "Well, you're rock and roll." I said, no, you got to listen. No, you couldn't even, back in those days, they wouldn't even let me in a door. I don't really.
You were
remember.
Playing a lot of covers back then, or were you writing at
always
the same time, or what?
Pretty much originals. I started writing the day I got a guitar. I wrote a song that night. And
who'd you try to like emulate? I know everybody starts out sort of.
I think I was always somewhere in my roots of. There's always some type of spiritual essence. If not, I don't want to use the word.
Mm-hmm.
I'll use the word Southern gospel, because mm-hmm. I was heavy into Southern rock and roll.
Right.
And I found there was something, a common
like
denominator.
Allman Brothers. And
Leonard Skinner,
of course.
Marshall Tucker,
yeah,
who we played with just
yeah.
a couple weeks ago. And they was every bit as good
yeah.
2 weeks ago down in Louisiana.
Marshall Tucker's
great. Oh, they burned
him
up.
In Branson a couple
fantastic.
Of years ago. I had the pleasure of an honor of being on stage with them. Mm. That guy can
I know.
Rip it still.
Yeah. It was amazing.
Yeah.
Marshall Tucker, they were a huge influence. Charlie Daniels was a huge influence, but yet so was Johnny Cash and Glenn Campbell. My dad always had Glenn Campbell 8-tracks. Mm-hmm. He had Merle Haggard, Glenn Campbell, Johnny Cash, George Jones, obviously Hank Williams Jr., the Scruggs. Whether it was Ralph Stanley or Mountain Boys or just like we loved going to bluegrass festivals. And so I loved bluegrass. To me, it all felt I never even really thought of any style of my music. I loved Led Zeppelin and ZZ Top. And
right.
I loved all that 60s and 70s rock and roll.
Country rock was really going on back then. There was a good mix of it. There were the Eagles who were really...
The Eagles were so huge.
Crosby, Stills, Nash. And
I never ever found myself in a position wondering, like, what am I going to call what I do or what is the style that
right.
I do? I never ever put that burden on myself. I said, what you do is you play what you feel and just keep it real. And
as far as your writing goes, was that... Did you write from personal experience at first or did
there's only been a very, very small, I can only think of, I almost really can only think of one song that I ever wrote on purpose.
Some came all.
And that was the
some,
verse.
Some gave all.
Well, see, But Some Gave All, I wrote that song, but I never intended on writing that song. I was just driving home from my gig in West Virginia, and I do like this. For people on radio, you can tell my hands going from the air to the top. My songs seem to fall from the sky. Like, I don't know where they come from, but it's when I'm going through something, the words and the music just comes to me. And I, back in those days, I'd have a micro cassette and I'd just sing the song. All of Some Gave All came to me on US 52, leaving Huntington, West Virginia on a Sunday night. In the last week of May of 1989. And that was right around time Buddy Cannon had came to see me. I guess it inspired me a little bit. And then on a Tuesday night, I wrote Where Am I Gonna Live When I Get Home. My first wife had set all my stuff out. And so on Wednesday morning when I pulled up to my house, I said, Where am I gonna live? Where am I gonna live?
And I, Where am I gonna live when I get home?
And I go, boom. And I... I'm sitting in front of my house singing, Where Am I Gonna Live When I Get Home? My old lady throwed out everything I own. She meant what she said when she wished I was dead. So where am I gonna live when I get home? And then that's how they come. So I just sing the melody.
Well, Some Gave All, was this somebody that you personally knew?
Yeah. So that, so Where Am I Gonna Live was Wednesday morning, but it was a Tuesday night that evolved into Wednesday morning. Then Wednesday night, I felt really sad. I'd messed everything up, and it was a horrible mess, and everybody was sad. So that night at the bar, went back to the bar, and I wrote a song called She's Not Crying Anymore. And then on Thursday and Friday and Saturday, I didn't write any songs. And then on Sunday night, I met Sandy Kane in Huntington, West Virginia. And he was a Vietnam veteran that had... I knew everyone that came in that bar, and I'd never seen this man. I knew that he was either traveling or perhaps a drifter, or somehow he was just coming through town. And so I introduced myself between the on the last break, between the third and the fourth set. And I said to him, I said, are you a Vietnam veteran? And he said, yeah. And I said, can I buy you a drink? I got him a drink and said, you got any songs you want to hear? And he wanted to hear some Creedence and some Lynyrd Skynyrd and like all the favorite things I like playing anyway. And then I did the fourth set, and then driving home that night, I was documenting in my micro cassette. I met Sandy Kane tonight, and he reminded me of a statue I used to see when I was a kid in Kentucky. There was a statue of a soldier that said, all gave some and some gave all. And then I just started singing. His name was Sandy Kane. So I said, I knew a man called him Sandy Kane. Few folks even knew his name. And just the rest of the song came.
That song is just as relevant today as it was then. And it was the Vietnam veterans back then, as I remember it. You know, they never got a parade when they came home. A lot of them were spit on and cussed at and really rejected by and forgotten and for what they did over there. I had a lot of friends in college who were really messed up by the war. And I was, when the memorial came along, which I think was mid-90s?
It was erected by 1992.
Yeah, and a lot of them had gone there, and it was finally starting to turn that they were finally getting their homecoming is what it felt like. And I went over there myself. A friend of mine, Steve Driscoll, his brother, has his name on that wall, and that was something else. But that's a great song.
Thank you.
And you play for a lot of veterans groups. Have you been out on the USO or around playing in?
Oh, yeah.
Played for the military at all?
We play a lot. Yeah. Played in, you know, all around the world.
Yeah. I'm sure you
actively
really
in two separate
that.
War zones.
Oh, really?
You know, yeah.
Where?
Both Afghanistan and Iraq.
Oh, really?
Yeah, on the ground and me running around this guitar. The case I carry to this day still has mud on it from Afghanistan.
Really?
I'm never going to wash it off.
Yeah.
And, but... That song, ironically, back to that 1 week of 1989, I ended up writing three of the songs that was on the 10 that would eventually come out in 1992. Well, this was May of 1989. Wow. I still had a long way to go. There was still, like, it took a long time for that deal to even...
So they wrote three songs in just about a week. Your first record.
That's right. Those three songs came that week of 1989, and Some Gave All being the title cut. Now, when they signed me to the deal, the first song I cut was Some Gave All, but that left nine more songs to cut. And I had written most of the other nine, but I did hear a very rough demo, very primitive, written by a Vietnam veteran named Don Von Tress. And as soon as I heard it, I stood up. I was in my guitar player's house. I stood up and said, "That's me. I love that song. Let's go work it up." And we went to the little lounge that I played, the Ragtime Lounge.
Yeah.
We worked it up that day. It was called Don't Tell My Heart.
Don't Tell My Heart.
And from that moment on, that night, people just all night long hollered, "Play that Achy Breaky song. Play that Achy Breaky song."
Was Achy Breaky even
it was in
the lyric?
It was in there.
Yeah.
But it was called Don't Tell My Heart.
Yeah.
And from that night on, it seemed very obvious to me that that song was probably called Achy Breaky Heart. And when I went and recorded it, then just a few weeks later.
So it was your fans that were telling you what it was.
They said Achy Breaky Heart. The people in the bar, they said, "Play Achy Breaky Heart." And I met Don Von Tress at the Music Mill where I recorded the album. And it's the first day we met. And he said, "Thank you for writing Some Gave All." And I said, "Thank you for writing Don't Tell My Heart." He said, "Oh, thanks, man." He said, "They say that song's going to do good." And I said, "I hope so, man." And I said, we didn't know each other, so I didn't want to, like, step on any toes or anything. So I said, "Hey, have you ever thought about and wondered if the title is right?" And I felt really bad even saying that. But I said, "Did you ever wonder if the song should be called Achy Breaky Heart?" And he said, "I don't care what you call it. Just put it out." And so the record company changed it to Achy Breaky Heart.
Yeah. Well,
luckily it worked. So Don and I.
Everybody knows Achy Breaky Heart.
He joined the band. Yeah. I put Don in the band, and he became my best friend, my songwriting soulmate. To this day, I wrote more songs with Don Von Tress. And what would happen, again, I don't write on purpose, but Don and I would travel together, whether it was a Learjet
just
or on
inspire
the bus.
Each other, right?
And if I had something coming to me, I'd go back to the back, and I started getting recording gear for the back of the bus way before it was cool to start making in-home studios. Mm. But again, I just never really fit into that Nashville mold and that Nashville sound. And to me, it was always about making things real. And I found more realism just by keeping it raw.
Right.
And Don would come back, he
became very produced by that time.
Yeah.
It was kind of the end of the Outlaws era and moving into what became the sort of country. I mean, it was going more pop and more produced. And
one of the first songs Don and I wrote together was, I was telling him one night, and this was right after the first album came out and he had joined the band. And first thing we did, first time Don and I ever played together, and this wild. You reminded me of it when you mentioned the wall. Don met me at the Vietnam Veterans Wall in Memorial Day of 1992.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a motorcycle rally called Rolling Thunder.
Right.
And Don Von Tress was going to join me in the band. And he went and touched that wall for the first time. And he did two tours in Vietnam. And he knew a lot of names on that wall. And it was a sad day. It was raining. And I remember even, you know, Don saying to me, "It's so appropriate that it just feels like it should be pouring the rain." And we did Some Gave All that day, and it was after that. I said, "Man, I don't know what you got going on, but if you want to just join the band." Well, he did, and pretty soon I started telling him things that had always been important to me, of like the environment. I was singing about going green way before it was cool to sing about going green. Even as a young kid, in some ways, I was a bit of a terrorist because, oh gosh, that sounds horrible, but like a Greenpeace terrorist, like save the environment terrorist. I'm yes. digging my hole deeper right now.
Getting in front of the whaling boats and all that.
What I would do, if I saw a tractor coming to tear up our forest to build new houses, me and my brother would go out in the middle of the night and take the gas caps off and put dirt in the gas tanks.
Does that come out of your faith? Do you have a faith in particular that you...
Oh, I have a faith.
You consider yourself a Christian?
I consider myself a Christian. I consider myself I like combining all the beliefs. And I think right now we're just really in a spot to, certainly I believe that Jesus Christ lived and died for my sins. And, you know, there's no doubt John 3:16, that's my faith.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I do know that the Native Americans had the belief that if there is a Heavenly Father, which they said, there's a Heavenly there Father, oh, Heavenly Father, you know, oh, Great Spirit, mm-hmm. Heavenly Father. Well, if there's a Heavenly Father, there must be a Heavenly Mother. And that faith is the Mother Earth. It was obvious. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, you got the Father, the Mother is the Earth. And the Mother, you got to take care of her. She's fragile. And we're depleting her and abusing her. And you could see it coming, but by the time 1992, 93, and all this started happening, and about that time the dolphins started washing up on the shores, and because of CNN and the visibility that all of a sudden we was able to see around the world, we didn't see that stuff a whole lot like before that. And as the world started expanding into our television sets, we were able to see that, my God, this is bad. The Native Americans are right. We got to take care of the earth. And Don and I wrote a song called Geronimo. Geronimo is exactly about taking care of the earth and being a light in the world, along with I told him about the
connected to the world too.
Just being connected
in the spirit world, the Native American culture, but the animals in the forest, they worshipped everything. There was part of the Great Spirit, the bear, and the bear is very fascinating. Mm. You know, it's almost godlike, and the buffalo, and their reverence and a respect for everything, and knew how everything was a part of everything else and dependent on everything else. Their culture was I myself am an honorary Oglala Sioux. I met Jim Red Cloud's Jim Red Cloud. He was the grandson of Chief Red Cloud, who had taken the Sioux back to the reservation
what a great man.
I met him in Houston. He was working as a security guard, and I used to hang out at his house. And this is in the middle of Houston, but all kinds of animals and birds would just show up at his house. You know, you ever seen those big flocks of birds that, you know, are like a cloud at night sometimes, you know, before they light down? Mm. Well, they would light down right at his house, like hundreds of them. I learned a lot from that guy. But anyway, I had an amulet that was from the Oglala Sioux tribe by the medicine man there. And my name was Ishimata, one who makes music. So, but I've always
had a
real affinity for Native American culture.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot to be learned and a lot that we still can learn. 2 years ago, I was contacted by Mark Ruffalo. Do you know him?
Yes. Yes.
Is he a friend of yours?
I know him, yes.
You and him. Oh, I'm having a vision. You and him doing something together. You talk about pure power. You and Ruffalo. Oh, man, I'm having a vision on this. You need to meet him.
We both had a relationship with Meg Ryan, so why not?
Oh, what? I don't know nothing about that, but I can tell you, Mark Ruffalo, he is a good spirit like you. And you mentioned the Dakota Sioux in North Carolina, Dakota, South Dakota, that region. He was going there and has for years went there. I for a long time have been bothered by the missing and murdered indigenous women and the fact that there is no statistics. In Washington, D.C., you could disappear from other places, and there'll be a statistic on you,
right.
But for young girls from the Native American tribes, for years and years and years, they've disappeared, and there wasn't even a statistic in Washington, D.C. saying Susie Joe was gone from the reservation.
Even though they may have been reported, because I mean, the reservations were basically nations unto themselves.
That's right.
Not, you know.
And they had no addresses. What Ruffalo was doing was he was going to the Dakotas to help get the Native American addresses so they could register to vote. And so I went and joined him on this trip 2 years ago. Hmm. And do you know that they what I thought was so beautiful, number one, these kids got an address. For the first time, they could realistically say, I live on the Sioux Reservation on Long Street at where. But they had, so they're out right off the bat.
That's a big deal.
If a child goes missing,
yeah.
They had an address.
Right.
Second of all, their voice, they had a voice to vote. They came out and registered to vote. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's North Dakota or South Dakota, they elected their first female indigenous legislator in Washington, D.C.
Fantastic.
And it was a powerful thing to see the there is a great power when people unite. And mm-hmm. again, for me, all of us as human beings, it's about purpose and finding our own. What is our way that we can give back in some way to, you know, help our fellow man and help our earth, help the animals,
really what it's
whatever
about.
It is.
It's not about the guilt of what happened, really, in the 19th century. You know, that was kind of a terrible thing, the way that Native Americans had their culture and their lives and property and everything taken away from them. But it's really more about here we are now, and let's all help each other. Mm-hmm. We can only enrich each other by where we came from, and let's help preserve each other's culture.
Amen.
And that's where it's at, I really do believe. And even when you talk about it that way, you're really talking about the red words of Jesus, really, which is the way he operated.
Love thy neighbor.
Yeah.
And people say, you know, back in the day, you'd read these bumper stickers that said, God is love. Mm. Whoever wrote that nailed it. When you combine all the religion, you look at everything, you go, oh, yeah, it's hard to define this and that, but I think you could pretty much get it right there.
Yeah, God, or as Matthew love. McConaughey would say, G-I-L.
Huh?
But G-I-L, God is love. And that is true.
I've never heard him say that. He's always trying to sell me a Lincoln.
He always had a J-K-L.
Every time I see him, he's selling me a new Lincoln. You know what I mean?
Matthew says J-K-L, which is just keep living.
Man. Hey, I went through this phase. I hope this don't sound horrible, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. I went through this stage. It started about 2 years ago. I started asking myself, I was pretty religious at that point. And, you know, you see these bracelets that say WWJD. What would Jesus do? Mm-hmm. I wore one for years. But I found myself in this turbulent time period of my life. And I don't know, maybe it has something to do with becoming an old man. And things get a little heavier. And where I didn't fit in before even felt like I fit in even less. Mm-hmm. And somewhere some things came into my life. And I started saying, WWJD, what would Johnny do? And I started trying to answer everything that questioned me. I'd say, what would Johnny Cash do? Mm. And even down, you know, to when this deal came up with Old Town Road and Lil Nas X. And is it country? Is it not? Is it this? Is it that? I asked myself, I said, what would Johnny do? Well, Johnny was never one to close the door and on the expansion and inclusiveness of what music should be. I mean, you talk about a man
Bob Dylan.
I mean, right.
Yeah, way back in the day.
And I said, what would he do? I said, well, number one, they ask you to come sing with this kid. I'm going to come and sing. I'm going to stand beside him. And then they asked me to write a verse. Talking about songwriting on purpose, that's the only song I can think of that I ever wrote on purpose was my verse in Old Town Road.
Yeah, well, Lil Nas, I was talking to David Ferguson yesterday.
Mm-hmm. I love David. I love Fergie. Yeah.
And,
is he out here?
No, I saw him in Nashville. Mm-hmm. I was there yesterday. But he was telling me that Lil Nas X had he had written the song and put it on TikTok or whatever, and they saw it spike or whatever, but he was thinking about you even before they had contacted you.
Fergie said that about me?
No, Lil Nas was thinking about you.
Oh, yeah. Because I think about Fergie all the time. I love him.
Example of country music. He'd watched Hannah Montana. He was
Fergie watched Hannah Montana, too.
Yes. We all did it, except for me. I'm a little too old. anyway, when it came out, they taken it off the air because it didn't have enough country elements in it, correct?
Yeah.
And how did you come into the picture?
Well, that's a good question. Who would think to add me as the country element? But they asked Lil Nas, and said, well, who's... He said I was the only country guy he knew. And so the song... You know, came into my world. I listened to it. I said, oh, I love it. But, I mean, you know, what's there that I can do to
and
it?
And they said, you to write a third verse or whatever?
Well, no, they didn't tell me that in advance. They didn't tell me that till I showed up to go sing it.
Oh.
But I did fall in love with it so much, they said, when can you come sing it? And I said, today. And it was on a Friday, and they couldn't get an engineer that late on a Friday. So they said, how about tomorrow? And I said, I'll be there. And that gave me time to, I went in, I started asking Alexa, Alexa, play Lil Nas X, Old Town Road. It would play, and I go, wait a minute. In some ways, that's just that roots rock, feel-good country, mandolin-driven music that I grew up on with my papo down there playing
fiddle.
Yeah,
and it really sounds like old-time gospel. Like it was written long ago.
That's right. And so I started, then I worked up my vocal parts. I said, I'm going to go in there and sing it. Then when I showed up, that's when they said, we want you to write a verse. I go, oh, you didn't get the memo. I don't write on purpose.
Yeah.
And
Fergie said that you said, I only write in out of desperation.
That's right.
Man. I can't just do this.
Yeah. It's best described in, I hate to even say this, but I usually have written my best songs when inspiration and desperation collide.
Yeah.
And it's somewhere in the insane chaos that a song will fall. I don't know how that works.
Yes. But I understand that.
It's somewhere in the dust. I don't know.
Out of the ether.
Out of the ether.
Right. Mm-hmm. Become manifest.
Yeah.
But
luckily today we got in there, SoundCloud.
Yes. Alexa.
Yeah.
Alexa, write me a song.
Yeah, Alexa.
But you get in there and you didn't get the memo.
Get the memo. I said, well, luckily they had brought in a very successful rap writer, a young lady named Jazzy. And Jazzy's like, I said, well, I'm sorry, ma'am, but I can't write on purpose. And she goes, all this is about taking you and putting you in this song. She said, look at you. You got your hat down. I had on a ball cap like you did, and it was sitting kind of low. She said, you got your hat down. And then...
That started it.
I was holding my guitar. I said, well, I did drive across town and brought my brand new guitar. She goes, that's a brand new guitar. And within 3 minutes, we just spat out some words. I mean, 3 minutes. Like, she said... I don't know, for some reason, I thought it was funny to say, baby's got a habit, diamond rings and marijuana. And they go, Tish was sitting in there too, and they go, baby's got a habit. And she goes, I love diamond rings and I love marijuana. And then it's like, but I don't think you should sing that. But she was carrying a Fendi bag, like a purse.
Yeah.
And Jazzy said, baby's got a habit, diamond rings, and Fendi sports bras.
Yeah.
I don't know what a Fendi sports bra is. I probably need one, but sounds good.
Not yet.
And then,
not yet.
No. And then I started going, hey, I said, you know what? In the 80s, when I lived out here, I said I lived here about a decade and thought Rodeo Drive was called Rodeo Drive. And every time I go get in there in my car, I said, oh, man, I got a gig down at Rodeo Drive. I just thought, what a dumbass I must sound like. And they go, that's it. And say something about Rodeo Drive. And then Tish or Jazzy, one of them, said something about
Maserati.
I was like, I would never thought of a Maserati. But something about that felt just right to go in there.
Yeah.
Maserati. And then I had, for me, the only thing I said, I said something about the Marlboro Man. Something I think about my dad, Marlboro Man. And then... said, now all we got to do now, let's just button it up and take it all back to Old Town Road. And so we did, and it was 3 minutes. And then she sent me in the vocal booth, and then I started singing it like a little Nas. I was doing the like the low rap, you know, and everything low. And she's like, no, no, no. She said, you should go twice as high. I said, oh, no, I can't go twice as high. I said, that's crazy talk. And she said, just try it one time. So I went up, hats down, and she said, that's it. That's it. And so I would have never thought of that. I would have never thought of going up to
So
I had some
when
help.
Things like that happen to me is like a little tinge of fear goes up me or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's good to get out of your comfort zone. And yeah. Don't you think?
I think, oh, you got to. You got to. Hey, everything in life. You know what I told Lil Nas early on? I think about this a lot when I talk to kids. If I go talk to songwriters or whatever, anybody in this business, no matter what you're in this world today, whatever your expertise or whatever your profession, don't try to think inside the box. Don't try to think outside the box. Think like there is no box, because there is no box. All the walls have been taken down, and there is no box. If you
just
can
be
think
as
it,
authentic
you can
as you can be. Right?
If you can think what, it, you can.
All that the voice great, inside, you know, inside you.
Yeah, that's
that you
right.
were talking about.
That's right. Yeah.
That's it.
That's it.
But that song is irresistible. And oh, I was thanks. Like that night at the Grammys.
Oh
was,
yeah.
What a performance. I mean, it was really just the hit of the entire show. And backstage when you came back and you were playing guitar with the choir there.
Oh, yeah.
That was
yeah.
such it was
oh,
just, that you. Was that was it was such a joyous
thank
joyous
you.
Time, man, that you really put out for people.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, they're starting to talk about our time.
Oh, are they?
But I did.
You got anything on your mind you want to ask?
Well, or? we didn't get in except your lovely wife, Tish.
She bailed on us.
Yeah, she bailed
she's
on
like
us.
She got but stuff to do.
You guys met you around the time that. Of Achy Breaky
yeah,
Heart,
and
right?
You wouldn't believe her now. She got like movies going on. She's got, I mean, it's she manages Miley, Noah, me.
She's the gatekeeper for you. She was protecting you at the Grammys.
She is something. She really is something.
A really beautiful gatekeeper you
and
got there.
I'll tell you what, she is. She's remarkably strong. And again, she comes from exactly where I come from,
yeah.
Those hills of Appalachia. And there's something about the fact that, I mean, now she's this song I'm singing by Neil Diamond, LA's fine, the sun shines most of the time. And it's about the truest thing you can say of all the good and bad and different things of living different places. There's one thing about LA, they got the weather.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? For
that
the most
is the
part.
Truth.
Whew,
love
man,
it.
I got the weather.
Well, we didn't really get to get deep into you. I think it deserves another visit here on the Denisons sometimes.
But just don't mention peckernets. Do not.
I'm gonna start a peckernet farm.
You know what?
I think that's what I'm out to do.
Man,
now that could be the pet rock of the next Christmas season.
Dude, that's a lot to be. Seriously, I want to go there. I'm going
to
bring all my dogs
I
and
love
come
to.
See you.
But we didn't really get to get into it. Well, we got it right up to
Achy
Breaky Heart.
Anything you want to ask? I got time. Whatever you want to do.
Well,
you got something on your heart? Anything you want to talk about?
I would like to save it for the next time.
I think
all
that's
I can
good.
Tell you is that, you know, I just love being with you here today. There's so much in common that you and I have. But I think so many people... of your fans feel that about you. And I think that's the reason that you've had durability and that you've lasted is because you have a joy in your heart for what you do. And that it's held up, and I'm sure it's been tested many times, but you're a great star, you're a great artist, and I really appreciate having you here on the show.
Thank you for saying that. And I'm gonna leave you with this. It ain't anything great that I did or anything. Persistence for one reason. It's not a very glorified word, but just the fact of keeping on, that combined with, luckily I had some really good friends that came into my world, like Dolly Parton and Carl Perkins. Mm-hmm. Waylon Jennings, the guys and the girls that said, keep it real and remember this word. Dolly, most importantly, she overemphasized it over and over. She'd say, reinvention, reinvention. And just when you think you've done something, don't be afraid to try something new and go reinvent. And luckily, that word, it's to this day, I don't know where I'm going to go from here. Just sitting here doing a podcast, this reinvention to me.
Yeah, same here for me.
This is the new world. This is the new world. So yeah. I'm glad to be here. We're going to get together on the farm, and I can't wait till we build a fire and sit under the stars, and we'll have a powerful time.
Yes, we will. We did today, too.
It's going to happen,
Thank
brother.
You, Billy Ray.
It's going to happen.
God bless you, buddy.
Yeah, you too. All right. I like this.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Denisonce. Please make sure to rate, review, and of course, subscribe so you can get new episodes delivered straight to your podcast player. Hey, and make sure to tune back in next week.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.